San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District Zone 3 meeting, called to order July 20th, 2017. And so, Andre, you want to do a roll call?
Member Shaw?
Here.
Vice Chair Iketa?
Here.
Member Barnidge?
Here.
Member Brunet?
Here.
And Member Gehring?
Here.
So we're going to start off this meeting with our annual fiscal year rotation of officers. So the agricultural representatives, being Brian Talley and Bart Iketa, will move to chair, and then our member at large, Mr. Jim Gehring, will move to vice chair. So we just need to acknowledge that.
We don't need to vote on that, right? We
just, nope.
Okay. Is that okay with you, Jim?
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's per the bylaws.
All right. All right, so on item three, we're up for public comment. Anybody would like to speak before the board? This is a good time for that. Seeing no one, we'll move on to approval of the minutes. May 18 minutes.
I would move for approval.
I'll second.
First and second.
Okay, motion passes. We'll move on to the operations report. So as of yesterday, the Lopez Lake elevation was 497.26 feet. Storage is at 29,445 acre feet. We're at 59.8% capacity. The rainfall to date is 0 inches because we just restarted at the water year. It goes with the fiscal year, actually. And the plant production is 4.75 million gallons per day. Downstream releases are 3.8 million gallons per day, and the state water is 1.7 million gallons per day. Do you have any questions on that item? No?
I have a question. I'm wondering, Mark, you didn't bring that latest reservoir projection that Jill did by chance?
I think that's next. Is that next?
That's next, yes.
Okay.
I always have a question for you. Is there water flowing into the lake still?
There is from the Arroyo Grande and from Lopez Creeks, but some of the local creeks are dry.
Oh, Arroyo Grande Creek is still going.
Wasn't that wet a year?
So in a wet year, it'll run all year long?
No, but they would run into, like the creek past my house, and run through June at least in a wet year. This year it stopped a couple months ago. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. So the next item, the projected reservoir levels.
Yes, and we have Public Works Engineer David Spiegel, who will go over that.
It's a pleasure to meet all you guys. You guys have probably seen my name in a few emails. I'm David Spiegel. I work under Jill, and so I think, Mr. Gehring, I think the projection that Jill had sent, the latest one, was actually a LRRP justification projection. Currently, we're kind of working through that and making sure that the numbers look good and stuff. And so there's still a little bit of back and forth, but right now, the one that you have in your packet is not that one. This is our standard projection that we prepare for the monthly meetings. And then we will be using that LRRP justification that actually looks at past usage, where this is actually looking at future projections and rainfall, where the LRRP justification looks at past rainfall data and usage. So it's kind of a worst case scenario. So if you guys look at the Lopez Reservoir Storage projection that's in the packet today, you can see that the projection, I know it's very short, we're getting ready to push it out a few more months. It's mimicking about what the same kind of usage was back in June, July of last year, So it's looking pretty accurate at the moment. And then hopefully next month we can push out a few more months and look at our future rain projections and see what it looks like.
Okay, any questions for David? So Jim, thank you. The other projection that you were referring to, is that, Andre, that's something that will be discussed at the next TAC? Is that?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question, Board.
The projection that he's asking for is different than the one that's here, correct?
But it goes out further in the future.
Yes.
But apparently it's still a work in progress. So, but the takeaway was the interim one looked like if the weather pattern held and was similar to what we had in 2015, we would be looking at hitting the LRRP trigger around October of 18. If I recall that correctly.
That's without rain?
Yeah, but that's apparently a work in progress. So,
David, will you have that for the TAC next month?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Any public comment on the operations report? Okay, hearing none, we're going to move on to some information items. Andrea, you used to have a climate update for us.
Yes. Okay, so not much has changed. We're pretty much status quo in regards to the U.S. drought monitor. So the Central Coast is still in abnormally dry conditions, as we're all aware. According to NOAA, for the temperature forecast for July, it's anticipated that we'll have above average temperatures than we usually do for this time of the year. And as far as precipitation goes, you know, equal chances of above average, average, and below average rainfall for July. So like I said, not a whole lot has changed.
All right. The next item is something that is just up for discussion. And maybe Andrea can give us a little history behind the televising these meetings. I was under the impression, to tell you the truth, that it was mandatory, but evidently it's not. So do you have some update for us?
Yeah, that's correct. It's not mandatory that these meetings be televised. Of course, having minutes and publishing the minutes, that is mandatory. I don't have a whole lot of information, but I did confirm with the Public Works Finance staff that we have been paying AGP Video for televised meetings since May of 2005. I've been authorizing payment for the invoices for about past 2.5 years, and every month we are paying $750 to televise the meetings. So that's $9,000 a year. So I don't know if there's been any difference in the cost since 2005, but that puts you near $100,000 to televise the meetings. There are other ways we could, you know, we could just audio tape the meetings if you'd like. Yeah, so that's pretty much the information that I have for you this time.
Any comment?
So it's $750 a month, even though we don't meet monthly?
Oh, excuse me, for each meeting. I'm sorry, each meeting.
Okay.
So we go down to $4,500. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
And so what's the cost difference if we just did audio?
That's something that we could just do ourselves in-house. I could just bring a recorder and do that. I know we do that for other meetings.
Yeah, you're talking about just bringing a little mm-hmm. recorder, and then you go back and do the minutes off of that recording, correct?
Sure. Yeah, as it is right now, when I do the minutes, I do go through AGP's website, and they have a video, so I see the video, but I'm really just listening, you know, to the audio.
So then where would the audio be uploaded to? To the county website?
Probably not.
We probably would not update it. We just have the minutes posted.
Okay, so it wouldn't be for public if someone wanted to listen to a meeting that, you know, they didn't come sit and watch or live, I mean.
Correct, because right now the public can go to AGP's website and pull up past meetings, but we wouldn't have them posted on the website, but we would have the minutes posted like we do right now.
Mm-hmm. What about... you know, this goes direct to the, ends up on channel, whatever it is, depending on what you have for cable, but mm-hmm. ends up on TV. What if it was videoed and just streamed on the web or something? But that's free, isn't it?
You know, I don't know. That's something we can look into. I could ask I can ask AGP Video about that, but we would have to pay somebody for that.
I don't have anything against AGP Video. I don't even know who they are, but that's who does our video. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you'd even need them. I mean, people take video on their phone, and so, but that's just an option. So, I don't have strong feelings either way, but if you could save $750 every meeting.
Why was it on our agenda? Did someone request it be placed there?
It's my understanding that Brian Talley wanted it placed on the agenda, and I think maybe it was something discussed at TAC, which I don't usually attend those meetings, so I wasn't present for that discussion.
It wasn't discussed.
It wasn't? Okay.
No. It was just something that Brian brought up.
I know there's also an option with AGP that you can, instead of having, I think the fee's lower, having the video posted on the website, that you just have audio posted on the website. And maybe, I mean, it'd be a savings. It wouldn't, you know, fully eliminate the $750 cost, but I think it might bring it down some of that.
Yeah, it does come in two options, video and audio. And to be honest with you, sometimes the video isn't even available. Sometimes it's just audio.
Well, maybe we get a quote for the audio only.
Okay,
if
I can do that for you.
That's a significant savings. We might as well save it if we can.
Yeah, I can do that, and I can either have that information shared at the TAC or just bring it back in September for the committee.
Yeah,
or
it would be good to see if there's any way to just do streaming, like if someone can just set up their
might be good to look into streaming it live, if someone could even, I don't know, do it with their phone, or, you know, you can get holders for a phone, and I don't know how official that is or if it complies with our regulations.
Well, and I'm wondering, streaming online through what website?
Yeah.
Good question. Don't know.
Yeah. So those are all options that, you know, I can look into, do a little more research.
Yeah. Get Jim, around. Jim, I don't know if you have any history.
Yeah. I don't. I just remember when we did start to televise, but I'm kind of wondering, is there any way to tell how many people are viewing the meetings on that channel?
Yeah, I can check with AGP. I know I've seen our meeting only once on the public access channel, so I don't know.
Our feelings are hurt.
But no, I always stop at my my kids get upset with me because I want to see what's on the county government station. But another, you know, thing we can do is see if there are any viewers watching this meeting, and they could call the office and let us know, hey, we want to keep watching that. Or if maybe we don't get any phone calls, then that's an indication that, you know, maybe there's not a big benefit to televising the meetings.
I think that's a great idea too, especially if we're going to bring it back to September. It would give 2 months that if the public were to, you know, bring it up in email or whatever to say, hey, no, keep it on. That would give us some frame of reference
right.
too.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Moving on to cloud seeding feasibility report. I think that's going to be you, right, Mark?
Yes, that's me. I have a Jill Ogren, who's not able to be with us this evening, provided me with just a quick update. There was a presentation made to the TAC in May regarding the cloud seeding feasibility study that was done as a joint project between the district and Zone 3. North American Weather Consultants prepared the study. They are the consultant that has worked with the County of Santa Barbara's cloud seeding program. For a number of years. They have recommended that we consider using a land and air-based program. Land-based would utilize about 4 sites, and the program is estimated to result in about a 9% increase in precipitation with additional runoff of about 3,000 acre-feet into Lopez Reservoir and about 10,000 acre-feet total for the watershed based on their model. That equates, when the cost works out for operational, it's about $29 an acre foot. The TAC recommended that we continue with preparation of the program. The next step is preparing the CEQA document, which is currently funded in this year's Flood Control District budget. And the final cloud seeding report is available on our website at slowcountywater.org if you want to look at the details of it. So progress is being made, efforts continuing, and we're into the CEQA analysis.
Any questions? I might have missed it, but they're guesstimating 3,000 acre feet into the Lopez.
Yeah, into the Lopez storage. So 10,000 okay. feet total on the watershed with about a 3,000 acre foot increase in runoff into the lake itself.
And that was at what cost?
$29 an acre foot. So
oh, okay. That's the part I missed. $29 an acre foot.
Is that $90,000?
29 or 27?
I think Jill said 29. Very large type, she wrote upon. $29 an acre foot.
Okay.
And so what's our next step?
Well, the next step with the CEQA document, that requires public notice and circulation of that document. And then likely the entire program would circulate back through the TAC and your committee for a recommendation to the board as to whether they should certify the environmental document and move forward with the program itself. We'd have to look at how we feel about ongoing funding and what an appropriate cost share would be between Zone 3 and other potential beneficiaries of that kind of a program. We're hopeful that as it moves forward, we can partner with Santa Barbara County so that especially the airbase part of the thing is simply partnered with the aircraft that they use that's typically at Santa Maria Airport. So okay. operational costs, I think, are estimated on that kind of an arrangement, a partnership between the two counties.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. I'm sure that's a hot topic that's going to be coming back. All right, water supply contract changes. That's you again, Mark.
That's me. So as you're aware, we signed an amended contract with E-Corp to use the model that was developed, the reservoir model that was developed for the HCP, take the same model, go back in time, and model different sorts of contract arrangements. So leveraging the investment in that very expensive model, so to speak. Staff report discussed some of the tasks. We've been working with the TAC and a subgroup to refine E-Corp's scope. They're looking at modeling a couple of options that are essentially based on the existing contracts, but add in the ability to have stored water, i.e. add carryover water into the existing contract, so a mix of that kind of an approach. In some ways similar to the way the low reservoir response plan works. So you develop those contract elements and then plug them into the model, and we should be able to show each agency what their water supply availability would have been all the way back to the reservoir going into operation. Another approach and another option they would model is what's called the Whale Rock Reservoir Model. That model, Whale Rock, allocates 100% of the water in the reservoir initially to the three participants based on a percentage of investment in the project. They don't per se keep a record of inflows. They just look at total reservoir volume, how much is in the reservoir today, and how much is your agency used back through the fiscal or the water year that they do. They do an interesting thing there. They have a downstream requirement. Both into the creek and also to the Cayucas water entities who have a prior right to the creek water. And they simply account for the downstream releases as a percentage or a proportional obligation of all of the participants. It's an interesting way that they do it, but it provides a simple model to look at and compare to more of the hybrid with using the existing plus storage. This is just almost 100% pure storage. And then, of course, the TAC, as they're going through these different things, has to consider the downstream benefits of the project right now and some interesting elements of the operation of the project. It seems like almost since the beginning of Lopez, it's been past practice to divert the maximum amount of water to storage that we can in the winter. And then in the summertime, as creek flows drop below usable, supplement the natural flows, both for fish and agriculture, sort of using that unallocated 4,200 in a more efficient way, rather than let it all go away in the winter and just save what we need for the municipalities. Since there's space in the reservoir, we save downstream water and then supplement summer flows. So as they're going through modeling, they have to make sure that that kind of an operation is accommodated. And then the TAC also discussed the idea that as we start honing in on potential modifications to the contract, we have to remember that these are discretionary decisions that will trigger a CEQA document. So there's an interest in the TAC in leaning towards, if we lean towards any changes that would not just cut to the chase, have a substantial environmental effect. So that we avoid a lot of time and expense in analyzing those in a higher level CEQA document. So just a couple of side things that swirl around the core issue of the modeling. So that work is moving forward. ECORC is going to go ahead with their technical evaluation, develop recommendations, and then bring a draft memorandum back to the TAC summarizing their results, take their comments, make any changes or additions, and then produce a final memorandum. Then the agencies individually will be able to decide what their interest is in contract changes.
Okay, any questions? I'm sure we're going to have a lot of questions down the road because that's it's going to be a hot topic. It's how does this affect the cities, Grover, Pismo, AG, as far as dollars and cents? I mean, are we talking about them storing? That's their, how am I trying to put this? They've got a lot of investment in that water, and are they going to be able to store more water? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, currently the agencies actually, outside the LRRP, don't store any water. They have a contract for service, so the district is obligated to operate the entire project in a way that best meets our contractual obligation to provide a certain amount of water. It just so happens that the cost of the water matches the cost of the facility, which is the way things are done. So the water's in the reservoir one way or the other. But the concept is that if an agency were to not use its allocation in 1 year, they don't have the ability to save it for the next year. It just becomes, it's called district water, or surplus water, and is available for some other agency in the next year. It just goes back into the pool. But when agencies have multiple sources, like groundwater or state water, and they're trying to manage all of those in the most efficient way possible, it's evident that sometimes the best thing for a particular agency to do is to store Lopez water for the next year, depending on what's happening with their other sources.
Which was the case for us when Pismo took all state water and correct, tried to save as much in the lake as they could for everybody else?
For their own needs and potentially for other ones.
Yeah.
And under the current contract, that's not possible. We've all agreed to depart from the contract in the LRRP, so this is an effort to essentially take the best elements of that and see if perhaps contract amendments would be a better way to go. Physically, when you look at what's in the reservoir, the major effect is it relabels the water that's already there. So we don't anticipate significant changes in reservoir levels or downstream availability for environmental or agriculture or any of that. It's simply a better way of managing the water resources that we have and that are obligated to the agencies. As far as the cost goes, that would probably not change. It's what's called a take-or-pay system. Everyone pays based on their proportional share of water. So the fact that an agency might have stored water doesn't mean in any given year or in any given set of years they would get more than they do now. They would just be able to manage it more efficiently.
Okay, any questions? I know that I just want to make one comment that Pablo's not here, but he was working on about a four-page I guess you can't call it an executive summary because it's so long, but it's got all these different options in it, and I think that's going to come out at the TAC.
Yes.
And then we'll be able to evaluate it and get it out to all the municipalities.
Correct.
But he's got questions in there about what happens when the dam spills, whose water's going over the dam, and which water's going over the dam. He has a lot of great questions in there, but that's going to come back to the TAC, I think, next month. Yeah. All righty. Any public comment on the information items? All right, hearing none, moving on to capital projects updates. Dave, you're back up.
I'll do my best here since Josh usually does these. Starting from the top, we have the Turnout Skater project. I've actually seen the data screens. It's looking very promising. I know IT's currently compiling all data and making it as user-friendly as possible, and the next step is obviously the login process, which they're working on now. The parking and roadway resurfacing, I know that construction has started on that throughout the county. However, most of the Zone 3 projects should be started and finished within August. We're going to hopefully push off the Lopez Water Treatment Plant surfacing till after we do our strainer repairs, because we're going to have a large crane in there and we don't want to tear up all the new asphalt that we're or the new slurry. The PLC, the membrane, and the six rack, that is all scheduled for the second week of August, and it will last for 2 weeks. We will be doing the PLCs and the strainers first during that first week, so the 7th through the 12th, and then the following week we will work on the six rack addition. But by the, I believe it's the 18th, we should be finished with all three projects. And then hopefully ramping up efforts on the equipment audit and replacement after that, once these bigger projects are complete. And I can go through all the upcoming projects, but it's probably stuff you've heard of already, so unless you guys have questions on anything in particular.
What is PALL, working with P-A-L-L? What's that?
PALL is actually the equipment manufacturer for the membrane strainers. Okay. Or sorry, the membrane racks. So.
Okay, any questions?
I have one question. So there was a project, I can't remember which one it was, that I heard from my public works director that was going to take Lopez offline for a couple weeks. And so we're going to need to pump groundwater.
Yes.
And what is that, and what month is that?
That will be the six rack.
In August?
Yeah.
Okay. So my question is just how hot it is and how much water we're using compared with maybe the rainy season. Mm-hmm. There was no way to sort of put that off?
No, not really, because what we're running into is you have rust that's coming off of those strainers, and the longer we wait, the more it's clogging up the, you know, the membranes, and it's just something that needed to get done now, you know, sooner than later. So, and with our contractor and Paul, it was the only like opportune time to get everybody on the, you know, at the plant at the same time. So if we could push it off till October, November, we definitely would, but this is the way it landed and can't really do anything about it. So
okay.
it was a scheduling nightmare with the contractor and the manufacturer. So.
Okay. And then just a question for Jim. When's the last time we, or how long ago did we pump only groundwater, and for how long?
I think the last time was we had a contractor hit a Lopez line and take the line out of service for about a week for repairs. And, it'll be another opportunity to watch and see what happens to our sentry wells along the coast when we're pumping groundwater as much as we will be during that period. So there'll be some learning to be achieved. But I think it's been several years ago that we actually had to all go on groundwater for about a week.
Okay.
And there are some charts that are available that show that. I don't know, I see Dan, you didn't bring a memory stick that's got that chart on it, did you?
No, I don't think I did.
Well, something for a future presentation maybe. But so during that time that we were all pumping groundwater, and I think it was a couple of years ago, there was a noticeable rapid drop in water level in all the coastal central wells. So that'll be something we're going to monitor this time around also.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and we will make all efforts. If we can get it back online sooner, we will. I know there's a little bit of a scenario where if they're working on two racks at a time, you know, we can all have the other two up and going, but sometimes it makes sense just to turn it off so you can just get everything done at one time. So,
yeah,
but we will do our best. So.
Okay, it'll be a good test to see what happens. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, David, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, any public comment on the projects? All right, hearing none, we're going to move on to action items. Update on the resolution to remain under the LRRP. Mark?
Got that. So you'll recall at your May meeting, the committee recommended submitting a letter to the board encouraging them to not terminate the low reservoir response plan with the focus of the agencies being able to maintain their storage. So we presented that to the board. We had Ben Fine from City of Paso led the charge, did a nice presentation to the Board of Supervisors, and so the board agreed and directed staff, Public Works, and County Council to go out and prepare resolutions and supporting documents to make that happen. That's been a chore, but those are being finalized to implement the board's decision, which again is continue the LRRP, or most features of the LRRP, through the end of the water year, so March 31st next year. So we plan to be back at our board August 22nd, have them adopt the formal resolution memorializing that direction that we got. So at this point, it is a lot of paperwork, but implementing a decision that the board's already made, essentially documenting.
So Andre, are there any questions for Mark, first of all? Do we need a vote on this? What happens here? Do you know, Mark?
I don't think so. I think this is under board action because it did go to the board and will go back, but at this point the board is we're all on the same page. The advisory committee, the agencies, and the Board of Supervisors. But it needs to be done formally, so that's what we're doing.
Okay. Thank you. It looks like you're up again. DWR Division of Safety of Dams. It's in our packet, but the Lopez Spillway Assessment Letter.
We have a PowerPoint for this one to try to give you a bit more background on what's going on. Things are happening rather fast. I'm going to see which button makes this go forward. So why we're here is because in the aftermath of the Oroville spillway failure, California Department of Water Resources, specifically the Division of Safety of Dams, so DSOD, you'll hear that, has directed that we perform a condition assessment of the Lopez Dam spillway. We are one of about 70 state-regulated dams that received identical letters, a copy of which is in your staff report, directing the creation of this assessment. So I want to give you a little bit of background, and also for anyone else who's watching this, what happened at Oroville. And we'll see from what happened at Oroville what the focus of DSOD's order is. And we'll talk a little bit about what they're requiring, give you a quick update on what we do have at the Lopez Spillway, what the focus of the work plan, which we're required to develop, is, who's been assigned to this project, and what we're intending as we move forward. So a little background on Oroville Dam. It is the tallest dam in the United States, which was a little bit surprising since it's an earth-filled dam. It was completed in 1968. It is 770 feet high. For context, the smokestacks at Morro Bay are 450 feet high. So simply go to Morro Bay, look up,
add 320 feet, and there you are at Oroville. 6,920 feet, over a mile across the crest. It holds 3,500,000 acre feet. Oroville Dam contains about two-thirds of the annual state water supply across the state, or about two-thirds of state water goes through the Oroville Dam on the Feather River. It has two spillways. The emergency spillway, which is essentially a second dam to the north of the main dam, is 900 feet long. The main spillway, the more typical one, has eight gates at the top. It's 3,000 feet long. That spillway, maximum capacity, it can flow 150,000 cubic feet per second. At that rate, it would fill Lopez Lake from zero to spill in just over 6 hours. It has, in the past, multiple times, flowed the full 150,000 cubic feet per second. There's a little red star up there where the Oroville Dam is, just outside the town of Oroville, as it is, about 70 miles north of Sacramento. Quick timeline. Overnight, on February 7th, the main spillway, about two-thirds of the way down the spillway, fractured. And we'll see a picture of that. Developed holes in the floor of the spillway. By the 11th of February, because they had shut flows off to the main spillway, water started spilling over that 900-foot-long crest of the emergency spillway, which was used for the very first time since the dam was built. The next day, they noticed geologic failure of the rock downstream from the emergency spillway. There was head cutting up towards the base of that. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the sheriff of Butte County had ordered an evacuation of over 188,000 people. I think we all saw that on the news and saw some of the issues that resulted from that. They reopened the gates on the main spillway and determined that the continued fracturing and breaking up would not threaten the dam itself, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So in 2 days later, lifted the evacuation. This last May, they were able to shut down the main spillway and control the reservoir level by releasing water out through the powerhouse at the base of the dam. April 18th, issued an emergency repair contract to repair about a third of the damage for $275 million. DWR's intent is to have those repairs made and the spillway safe by November 1st. This does not replace all of the damage, but it will is intended to stabilize the upper part of the spillway and make sure that the fracturing doesn't erode upstream and threaten the spillway gates and the dam itself. Quick picture of Oroville Dam from the air. The large structure to the right is the dam itself. Over there, so this is 6,000 feet over a mile across, and then the spillway itself some 3,000 feet down this way. You'll note something about these dams. The spillway is not carved into the fill of the dam. Spillway itself, and it's obvious at Oroville, is built into the natural hillside. So they're actually separate structures in this case. What you can't see is the emergency spillway off to the left, which again is a 900-foot-long separate dam from the main structure. It's interesting about this picture. It was taken in 1967 while the dam was being constructed. The floor of the spillway is in place, the concrete. They're building what's called the sidewalls. They're being cast. Right there is a water stain. There's actually water leaking out of a concrete joint in the spillway in 1967. That's not supposed to happen. So 2017 February, the initial fracture occurred right there. When they first shut down the spillway, this is what they were looking at. Substantial damage to the floor of the spillway, pieces missing. Concrete was actually flying into the air as water was churning out through this hole. And it's eroded underneath the sidewall, as you can see here, leaving it standing out in the open. After the spillway was used a little bit to alleviate the emergency, you can see that the fracture has gone all the way across. There's still some small amount of water
significant damage and a major hole in that spillway. This one, looking again downstream, water went out to the side, and chunks of the spillway laying in the hole that was eroded out. From the other side, substantial damage to the spillway. You can see the surface erosion is from water that literally foamed and splashed so high through this hose that it splashed backwards up onto the mountain, then eroded again. A couple of pictures. This one's showing what's interesting is the voids underneath the spillway. The original plans for the Oroville spillway called for what they call loose soil or incompetent base material, anything other than hard rock, to be excavated and replaced with concrete. It's evident from these pictures that that wasn't done that way. This should be solid concrete under here and all of these voids, and it's not. It's erodible rock. And there's quite a bit of the investigation focuses on the design changes that happened apparently during construction to deal with substantial amounts of unsuitable foundation materials that was uncovered during construction. What this picture shows, I had to do some talking with engineers to figure out why they showed this. I have this crack here in the slab, and then the slab downstream is eroded all the way down to the rebar, the single mat of rebar. And what they're surmising is that water through some cracks upstream flowed underneath the spillway. The drains were likely blocked. Keyed spillway drains were blocked. Fractured the slab and pushed it up into the flowing column of water, and that water eroded away the concrete all the way down to the rebar. This is the same kind of thing that was probably involved in this. It just hadn't progressed to the point where it broke that slab up and started lifting it and tossing it downstream. This is a picture 10 years ago, November 9th, 2007, that shows some maintenance issues. There's trees. These are very large trees because this spillway is huge, growing in the fill behind the sidewall. It's surmised that those tree roots are growing into the under drains, which you would expect. Those drains should pick up any water that goes through a crack or a joint, and at zero pressure, carry it out from under the slabs, down the side, and dump it back into the spillway. And if you look close, you can see water coming out of the drains here. This one's not flowing. And for a dam operator, that means there's a problem. This was 10 years ago, so it's an interesting photo. So what DSOD, in light of that kind of damage, has directed us to develop a work plan as to how we're going to go about evaluating our concrete. Oroville had significant cracking, some of the cracks as wide as half an inch with rebar exposed in the cracks. All concrete has cracks, but that's significant. They want us to look at the drainage system. Underneath that spillway is a whole series of drains that are designed to collect any water that gets underneath and move it out of the way without eroding the base material or lifting the slabs. So they want us to make sure there's no potential for slab undermining and then this wonderful thing called hydraulic jacking, which is the situation where water from above can flow underneath. If it has no way to get out, that water from above continues to push. And if you add up the pounds per square inch below a slab downhill, it can actually lift it up into the flow, and then we see the damage that happens when that occurs. The site investigation should also look at the spillway foundation material. What kind of rock is under our spillway? What's its condition? How erodible is it? Again, is it susceptible to erosion and instability? DWR came out today with a little bit more detailed description of what they expect as an outline for the site or for the initial site assessment and investigation that we're due to turn in September 1st, and it's consistent with all of this material. So up and down the state, all kinds of agencies are working on pulling these assessments together. I do want to point at this time, let me see what the next one, okay, let's compare. Feather River, Rio Grande Creek, both completed in 1968. Both are earth-filled dams, both have concrete spillways. But notice some interesting differences. Oroville at 770 feet high, and Lopez is 160 feet. over a mile across the top of Oroville Lopez at 1,100 feet. 3.5 million acre feet of storage at Lopez, 50,000. Lopez has one spillway. It's about 750 feet long. Has a capacity of about 40,000 cubic feet per second. And interestingly, the maximum flow in our records is just over 2,000 cubic feet per second. So the Lopez spillway has never been maxed out as far as flows go. I also need to stop at this point and point out that in 1970, after the dam first filled, 68-69, the spillway was discovered to have damage. There was some movement in some key components. There was some cracking that continued, separation of slabs. DSOD recommended that the county or the district watch those issues carefully. By 1990, there was enough concern in the Public Works Department, and I assume the TAC and agencies, that we commissioned an outside engineering firm to do an analysis of the spillway. They found some of those issues to be a bit more troublesome than DSOD did, so we embarked on a project to make significant repairs to the spillway. At the same time, Loma Prieta earthquake had happened in 1989, and the issue of liquefaction came to the forefront. And then shortly after that, Diablo Canyon published some of their seismic information about the West Wasna Fault and others. Lopez Dam is located within the West Wasna Fault zone. That liquefaction, new information about West Wasna triggered the work between 2000 and 2003, you'll recall, with the seismic retrofit of the dam. What I didn't know, and what's not commonly known, is all of the suggested repairs to the spillway were also made at that time. So broken concrete was removed and repaired, cracks were fixed, rebar was relocated, and significantly inspection and clean-out ports were added to the drain system. So if we were to take a tour today, you would see brass plates in the floor of the spillway that, if you open them up, actually give you access to substantial parts of the drains. So we don't necessarily have a spillway that's been untouched since 1968. We have one that was upgraded 17 years ago. And by all accounts, the work that was done then was good work and repaired all of those previous concerns. I don't expect you to look at this very closely. This leads into the next. This is one of the original design plans of the Lopez Dam. And two things to comment. This is actually a detailed sheet that shows the drains under the upper part of the system, upper part of the spillway. That's what all of these lines across here is. And the other key thing here is the initial look at these plans shows that the designers of Lopez Dam used the design standards that were in place at the day, established by the Army Corps of Engineers. What's evident in Oroville is they did not use the design standards that were in place in the 1960s. And there are articles and opinions coming out that some of those departures from design may have played a significant role eventually in the failure, along with changes made during construction, the difference between the design plans and the as-built plans. What we've seen in Lopez so far is there's very little difference between the design plans and the as-built plans, and that the design plans followed very closely to the details and the standards that were in place in the 1960s when the reservoir was built. So you go from plans to construction. Just for interest shots, this is a picture standing at the bottom of the spillway looking upstream, and you can see the tractors carving out the natural material to put the spillway in. Again, not bedded into the reservoir or not into the dam itself. If you ran up the hill a couple of weeks later and looked down, again standing on the base rock and all of that formwork at the bottom to build what's called the flip bucket. You know, the spillway comes down and then has a lip that sticks up in the air. It's designed to push the water out and away from the toe of the dam and the spillway itself. It doesn't actually move.
It's the water that flips, I understand.
At the top of the spillway, there's a thing that some documents call the weir, others call the OG, referring to that curve right there. But that's, and we'll see some other shots where you can see this when it's finished, but it gives you a sense of the material, the rebar that's in it, and the size. That's a worker down in there. Today, if you were to go up, this is all solid concrete all the way across, and where this gentleman is standing is when the lake is full, he's in the water. So the water spills over the top of this structure and down the spillway. Very complicated picture. All kinds of rebar and concrete. If you go up there today, you can see none of this. It's all buried. But it's what backs up the sides of the upper portion of the spillway itself. And if you want to get technical, that's what's called, I had to look this up again, something called a counterfort wall. And you'll read studies as we move forward over the next year or two of the counterfort section. And that just means the spillway where there's counterfort walls on both sides. The bridge itself on the road goes from the top of one counterfort wall to the other. And then a long, long distance shot. It doesn't show up here, but this is looking across the construction. And there's the sections of the floor of the spillway being formed and getting ready to be poured. And then the dam itself is rising up over here on the side, not yet completed. So today, that's a nice picture of the Lopez spillway. I put this in just to highlight those green lines and arrows. That actually demarcates the difference or the edge between native material and the dam itself. Not easy to see what you're up there. So this is the fill that forms the dam, and then across the top to the top of the counterfort wall. So you can see the spillway, again, is placed in native material, not fill. Nice picture from inside the spillway. There's the road bridge over the top. Here's the front of the counterfort walls, left and right. And just for a scale, that's a 2016 Ford Escape parked in there. It gives you a whole different perspective when you're actually up inside the spillway as to size. Again, compared to Oroville, maybe not the biggest thing around, but it's ours and we're proud of it. David provided us with these aerial shots. In a normal winter, this would be lake. It would be water, and it would spill over this structure. Notice that OG curve. We saw pictures of that being formed, or the weir section, and then flow down between the two counterforts. Another good shot, the spillway, third. These are from in the last couple of weeks, I think. And just to give you a sense of where the water is at 60% full. So what are we doing about it? In the Public Works Department, we have formed a project team. These are the key members. Obviously, Wade Horton, the Public Works Director, is the principal engineer, is ultimately responsible for the work that the team does, although his hours on the project are very, very, very limited. Management oversight is my job. Make sure the team has the resources it needs and is coordinating and working efficiently. David, who you just met from our utilities division, is our project manager. Again, this is to move the work plan forward and get it done by September 1st. We've contracted with John Hollenbeck, who's in the audience. John has extensive experience with hydraulic structures and dams, not necessarily spillways, but he's a strong background civil engineer. We also wanted someone on the team to provide an outside perspective, so it won't be entirely county staff guiding exactly where everything goes. We need an outside voice. By the way, that's our perspective, that all infrastructure is important, roads and bridges, but at the top of the list of criticalness, obviously a dam and a spillway, not only the safety of the community, but also to our water supply. Then within our department, who we have quite a bit of depth, Dean Benedix, who's our utilities division manager, has been with the department for a number of years. Jill Ogren, who you've met, that David works for. Josh Roberts, who recently came on board, brings a wealth of experience. Dave Flynn is our transportation and development division managers. All of these people, by the way, are civil engineers.
who can provide a different voice. And then Michael Boyce works on our construction division. Mike was worked on the management of the construction of the seismic retrofit, has extensive knowledge at the dam. When that project was completed, we hired him, and he has been our engineer responsible for interacting with the Department of Safety of Dams, monitoring the piezometer system, and providing, preparing the annual reports that go along with owning a dam back to DSOD. Those folks are there for help. Primary work is going to be David and John to get the work plan out. Funding. Zone 3 has a district-funded reserve, which we've looked at before. One of the categories there refers to, two years ago, I think, the TAC and with the advisory committee identified uses for that money, some capital projects, and then a generic category to support actions just like this, unanticipated, but which go towards water supply and public safety. We've reviewed the availability with finance and then reviewed it with TAC. TAC agrees that tapping into that for about $25,000 to $30,000 moving forward at this stage is appropriate. And so as a funding approach to Zone 3, we're suggesting we continue to look at the district-funded reserve so that there's no change at this point in any billings to the agencies. And that concludes my presentation at this point. Available for any questions you might have.
Questions?
One. So the 25,000 mark, that gets us the work plan, which I assume is, quote, the detailed evaluation of the dam.
Well, the work plan is intended to describe. We have to come back to DSOD and say, based on what we know about our dam, this is what we're going to do. So they don't want us to go do any work until they've approved it. But it's fairly obvious what we're going to do. And again, the document we received from them today is dead on line with where we were going with it. So it's things like what we'll present to DSOD is we'll say we intend to review all of the design documents. In our case, also all of the 1990 assessments and the 2003 construction documents.
But the cost, the 25 to 30, doesn't include, so that just includes here's what we're going to look at, or it doesn't include now we're looking at it?
No, it does not.
Okay, I thought that was cheap.
Yeah, it is. Well, it could end up there. Obviously, David is doing a ton of reading and pulling out documents, and then John will do the same. It's difficult to commit to, we're going to go read all the documents if you haven't at least looked at all the documents, that sort of thing. So it gets you into the first part of it, the obvious part. Some of the additional costs, if the decision is made we need to do this, right? So the work plan, after looking at documents and stuff, may say we need to bring in, say, an outside engineering geologist. Mm-hmm. To look at our geologic reports and really focus in on this question of erosivity and stability if there were a water leak, that sort of thing. I mean, that's where the focus is going to go, given the pictures that we saw. But again, we have to look at what we have to decide whether that's necessary or not, ultimately show that to DSOD and see if they agree. So outside number 25,000 to get us to the work plan, probably some back and forth with DSOD, and then see where we stand at that point.
Okay, thank you for that.
Any other questions?
I had one.
Okay, go
so,
ahead.
So I think you gave a timeline as far as September, but that's just this initial.
Yes.
Part. Okay, and then do you have some sort of obligation from the state to be done by a certain time, or is it just?
No, we don't. What's interesting, and the expectation, understanding DSOD and how they work, we expect that we'll have ample time at this point if we need to do a full investigation to get that scope down and get that done without doing it in a rush. And I say that because, if you think about it, there are other facilities in the state that were designed and built in the 1960s, and they've simply been operated and inspected annually and cracks patched and move on. Nobody's done a geologic review. Nobody, you know, all that work we did in the 90s and the 2000s wasn't done for those other facilities. Mm-hmm. So there might be a push on something like that to move ahead faster. Inspections of Lopez Dam by our staff and by DSOD's annual inspections don't show any obvious issues. We do have one slab in the upper section that's displaced above the one below it, which was known, by the way, in 1990, and it was decided that with the 2000 repairs it didn't need to be fixed. Beyond that, you don't see massive cracks, lack of maintenance. You don't see trees growing on the outside. So it's possible that there may be other facilities that need to do their full inspections in a hurry and get to the repair stage. At this point, anything's possible, but we haven't seen anything that jumps off the page as a major issue.
Okay, any other questions? So I think what we're looking for here is a motion, correct? Do we need to vote on this, Mark?
I think what we want to do is just whether or not your committee is comfortable with our funding plan, tapping into those reserves for this first $25,000.
So moved.
So we need a motion and a second?
That would probably be appropriate, just so we can report back to the board as we're going. Actually, in this case, we're working at the direction of the board.
Okay.
We want to be consistent with your perspective as well.
Okay. So we have a motion. We have a second?
I'll second.
Motion and a second. Any other discussion? We do have Christy. Is it Christy?
Christy.
With the finance here, if anybody has any questions for her. She's getting bored back there. She loves to speak in front of the public, if you guys didn't notice. Okay, we have first and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries.
Thank you.
All righty. Now the Santa Maria groundwater modeling. And I think that Dan Heimel is going to take over now. Mark,
yeah.
Do you want to start off here?
I'll do the easy part, and then if there's any hard questions, we'll ask Dan to come up and
awesome.
Answer those.
Deal.
Quick background, a couple years back, there was a desire among the agencies involved in the Santa Maria groundwater basin to move forward with a full groundwater model. The flood control district had prepared a basin characterization, identify structures and formations, and the next step typically in that scientific evaluation of a basin is to produce an actual model that would then help us understand the hows and the whys of where water moves and if you pump here or supplement there and that sort of thing. That was discussed early on that there would be possibly a cost sharing between the Flood Control General, Northern Cities Management, which is almost a direct overlap with Zone 3, and then the Napomo Mesa management area. There was some work to be done in advance of that. That didn't happen. Among other things, SGMA got passed and redirected some of the district funds. And then the project that you're all involved in for reclamation of water from the Pismo Beach plan and supplement into the groundwater basin came along, so situations have changed. But the idea of partnering and getting the groundwater model done for the benefit of at least the Northern Cities Management area has always been back on the table. So what you have in front of us is a proposal to use a portion of the, again, district-funded reserves, and there's a table on page 23 of your packet, to help fund the Santa Maria Groundwater Basin Modeling Project, which is a bit more focused in the northern part of the basin this time around, along with some of the fringe areas that the district has responsibility for. Note that back in a year ago, with our budget, is when the advisory committee looked at that district-funded reserve pool and earmarked certain monies in there for certain things.
You can see that the basin model was earmarked to $250,000 to come from that fund. The cost share right now works out to about $117,000. So this is an item to endorse going ahead. Again, what's happening, that same fund, and moving this more focused Santa Maria groundwater basin modeling project forward. I won't go much more into details. I think Dan is way better set up to explain the where's and wherefores of what the model would do itself. So we have a little bit of adjustment in what the focus of the model is, and a reduction in the cost share amount that would come from district funded reserves.
Okay, Dan, I think you're up. Unless anybody has any questions for Mark before we start. All right. Remember, you're speaking to a bunch of laymans.
No problem. Is this on?
I guess it is.
Yeah, I think Mark gave a pretty good introduction there, but I can a little bit more of the background and how this model fits in with some of the other water resource initiatives. Development of a groundwater model for the Santa Maria Basin has been really one of the top priorities for the Northern Cities Management Area Technical Group since the detection of seawater intrusion back in 2009. And there have been a variety of initiatives that have been started to try to develop a groundwater model, but as Mark described, we just never were able to get all the funding sources together and the momentum to get that project off the ground. However, as part of the regional groundwater sustainability project, which is the regional recycled water program that is currently being undertaken by the City of Pismo, South San Luis County Sanitation District, and its member agencies, Aurora Grande, Grover Beach, and Oceana Community Services District, we've been able to take some of the initial steps towards developing a groundwater model. So the request that has been put forward to the Zone 3 Advisory Committee is to use a portion of the funds previously set aside to help the groundwater modeling initiative continue. The other funding source for this groundwater model is settlement funds that have been negotiated between the South San Luis County Sanitation District and the Regional Water Quality Control Board. So those funds are going to pay for the majority of this next phase of modeling, approximately $221,000, and then the $117,000 is a supplemental source to allow for the full model to be developed. And the vision is that the model that is being put in front of you right now is really to support the recycled water program. It's designed to look at the scenarios for the injecting the recycled water into the groundwater basin to prevent seawater intrusion, and also to be able to pump that water back out to produce a renewable, sustainable supply for the region. Then once those objectives have been completed, it's envisioned that this model will be a building block for a larger regional model that will be used to help answer a lot of more comprehensive water resource questions in the area. So I think those are the main points, but I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee could have.
Questions for Dan?
Dan, can you just, I was trying to write down, you said there's $221,000 that's towards the project that's coming from a settlement between the Sand District and who else?
The Regional Water Quality Control Board.
Okay.
So there was a spill event in 2011. There was a fine ultimately negotiated between the Sand District and the Regional Board. Through that negotiations, the Sand District was able to advocate and receive approval to use a portion of those fine monies to support local water resources initiatives. And so one of them is the groundwater model funding, and the other was improvements to their headworks.
Okay, thank you. That's what I thought, but I just wanted to make sure and get the numbers. Thank you.
No problem.
I had a question. I was looking at your phase one and everything, and this is the Northern Cities And is Napomo paying anything for part of this study?
So at this point, the Napomo Mesa agencies aren't contributing to the modeling effort. Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons there is this modeling effort is really focused on the recycled water project, mm-hmm. But it is envisioned that the model that's generated for this would include portions of the Napomo Mesa management area. So it could be useful in future modeling evaluations of the groundwater resources in the entirety of the Santa Maria Basin within San Luis County.
Okay. And in your mind, maybe it's a question for Mark too, we are approving funding of from monies that already have been set aside for this project.
Yeah, that's correct. That was the direction from the advisory committee in 2016, is to set that money aside for groundwater modeling, admittedly the larger one, but we're not using all of the money, and we're moving towards ultimately a larger model with this.
Okay. Do you have any other questions? Any questions for Christy? She drove all the way here. All right, so do we again need a motion? Second?
We need a motion to fund the cost sharing.
I'll move that.
Second.
So, and second. Any other discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. All right, Dan and Mark, thank you. Do we have any other public comment on any of those action items? Seeing none, we can talk about any future agenda items. What does that mean, a fall update to Board of Supervisors? Andrea, what does that mean?
Excuse me. So that's something that we talked about at our last meeting in May, and we just want to keep it on here. So after we get the reads on the groundwater levels, we'll talk about that, and then we'll go back to the board and give them an update, and then that ties in with the LRRP.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And what about the safe yield of the lake? Is that just something that we're going to
That was something that Member Lee asked that we put on future agenda items. He asked me to do that at the May meeting as well.
Okay. So do we have any other future items that any of the board would like to see for the agenda in the future?
Nothing for me.
If you do, you can contact, I think we'd be contacting you, Andrea. I mean, kind of like Brian did in this case with this televising the meetings.
Sure. You can contact me directly, or if it's something that's discussed at the TAC level and you want to speak with Jill, she and I work right next to each other, so she'll just let me know that, you know, the TAC recommended that we add an item to the agenda to discuss.
Okay. All right, any other committee member comments? No? Okay. Meeting's adjourned.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.